Okay, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak. I'll talk about energy fluctuations in driven thermalizing and driven dissipative systems. So it's a mouthful of a title, so I'll have to explain what I'm asking in a few in a slide. The work was done with Guy Bonin, who is a PhD student at the Technion, and Luca D'Alessio, who is a PhD student at Boston University, and Anatoly Polkovnikov, which you all know. And Guy will also be presenting a poster on the work, and most of the details can be found in these two papers. So the question I'm going to answer is very simple. The first question I'll ask is, you take an isolated system and you apply some drive on the system. I have to define what I mean by a drive. A drive essentially means that I'm taking some external potential and driving it in some periodic manner. It doesn't have to be specifically periodic manner, but in just some way where the potential returns to its initial value as a function of time. And due to the second law, we know that on average, the energy of the system has to go up, or it has to go up eventually. And I want to ask, can we say something about the distribution of energies of the system as a function of time? So it's a very, very simple system. And I'll ask if we can say something. And the idea will be, and all the statements that I'll make is, that if the relaxation time of the subsystems is much, much smaller than the time scale involved with the drive and the coupling times, then we can say specific statements about the energy distribution. Essentially, I think the most honest way of describing this work is saying that we're using linear response in a way that it hasn't been used before, as far as I know. Once I'm done with explaining the details of this, I'll tell you essentially, because I don't have enough time, about results for a very similar question where you take two systems which are initially at different temperatures, so they have specific energy which corresponds to different temperatures of the two systems, and then we couple them in a weak way. Weak way just because I'm interested in fluctuations in mesoscopic systems. I'll get to that later. And what I know is that eventually these systems will reach thermal equilibrium, but I want to know what are the statistics of the energy of, say, system one as the system reaches equilibrium. Can we say something about the energy distribution of this? And again, in the same limit, where the relaxation time of the subsystem is much, much smaller than the drive and the coupling times, essentially, when each of these systems is very close to equilibrium, but the combined system is far from equilibrium, we can say concrete statements about how the system relaxes to equilibrium. And once I have these two pieces, I'll use this in a modular manner and study the relaxation to a steady state now of a driven dissipative system. So this is a system which is driven by some external potential and dissipating to some external bath. You can think about your favorite experiment. And this eventually reaches steady state, which is not described by a Gibbs distribution. And I'm going to say some things about how it reaches a steady state, and I think slightly more interesting about properties of the steady state. Essentially, I'll derive some sort of fluctuation-dissipation relation for this guy. And then just for fun, I'll show you similar results, because the whole thing is modular for a system connected to two baths. And we can again ask, how does this reach a, again, non-Gibbsian steady state, and what are the properties of this steady state? So these are the general settings, and to make the derivations very, very clear, I'll start with this system and study it in detail. And just to sort of humor you a bit, if you want to think of this, this is like taking a piece of meat or vegetable if you're a vegetarian, and heating it in a microwave. We say that we're heating stuff in the microwave. This is technically wrong. We're actually working things in the microwave because we're not putting heat into it, but try telling that to your family. And the other side is more like a conventional oven. So these are the two settings you can think about that. Okay, so I hope now you'll remember something. Okay, so what I'll do in the rest of the talk is as follows. First, I'll discuss in details the driven isolated case. I'll show you how we derive things. And in particular, I'll argue that one can observe two broad classes of distributions for how the energy of the system evolves as a function of time. I'll illustrate the idea behind the derivation in a really trivial example. The results are completely general, but I want to illustrate what's the idea by using a really, really simple system, which I can actually do online in the talk. And then I'll give you a general derivation of the condition of the relation and the condition for the thing to hold. And I'll use what people call fluctuation relations, and I'll try to convince you that it's a really easy way to derive fluctuation dissipation relations, which are connected to this work. And if you want to see a quantum version of this derivation, you can go to the poster of Guy or talk with Anatoly, Luca, or whoever you want. There's a good chance. We're all here, so a good chance that you can ask your neighbor. And I think this also gives some insight into the physics behind what I'm describing. I'll skip, we've studied this for many, many examples. I'll skip that. And then I'll just quote the results for driven dissipative thermalizing and driven by external bath, and then I'll summarize. So again, back to the question I was initially asking. We have an isolated many-body system. You could think of your favorite cold atom experiment. And it's sitting in some potential. And this potential is wiggling as a function of time. This can be by noise that you make on purpose, noise from the electric circuit, somebody bumping into the table, whatever you want. And due to the noise, the potential is fluctuating as a function of time. And we know that the second law of thermodynamics, I'm choosing the Kelvin statement, which is applicable here, says that there's no process is possible in which the sole result is the absorption of heat from a reservoir and its complete conversion into work. So that means that on average, the energy of this system, in modern terms, the energy of this system is increasing as a function of time. So the fluctuating potential can only increase the energy of the system. Just for humor, these are a few other statements by Lord Kelvin. I particularly like the heavier than air flying machines are impossible, just because he was looking at the sky and I'm sure he saw birds. But anyway, I guess it's a good sign when people are quoting you 100 years later on silly things you said. So, okay. So we have an isolated system, and we're changing the potential as a function of time. So the canonical stat-mech example is an isolated gas sitting inside a piston. And we take the piston and we move it back and forth. And imagine that you do it in some very, very slow process. In thermodynamics, we call this an adiabatic process, that we know that the energy of the gas inside this piston will follow some periodic function as we move the piston in and out. However, if we do this in an irreversible manner, every time we do the experiment, we'll get a different result. So if we follow the energy as a function of time in different experiments, we'll see that one time it follows one trajectory, and another time it follows another trajectory, and just repeat it again and get different graphs every time you do the experiment. So irreversible means that we don't know the outcome of the experiment, and each time we get a different thing. But the second law tells us that if we repeat the experiment many times and then average all these graphs, the average energy must increase as a function of time. That's a law of nature. Okay? So there's several questions that you can ask about the irreversible process. First thing, can we say something about the distribution of final energies in the system? Then I'll ask, how do they compare to changing the energy of the system by coupling the system to a thermal bath? So you can think about taking a system. This is my best animation. Coupling it to a bath at some temperature, the energy of the system changes by coupling to a bath, and then you detach the system, and each time you repeat this experiment, you get a different final energy, and you're asking, what's the distribution of energies? Well, it's a textbook result. It's temperature squared times a specific heat. And you can ask, for example, can the distribution that you obtain heat by the irreversible process be narrower or wider? And a final question, which is sort of hinting to the answer, can you classify different systems with distinct behaviors? So before going on to deriving the results, I want to give them to you. So if the drive is slow enough, still irreversible, the way I like to think about this, that this is the first correction to the adiabatic limit. This is actually what we're deriving. And then you can write that the variance of the energy distribution is governed by the rate of energy change in the system. So to put this in a very, very blunt manner, if you measure the average increase of energy in the system, repeat the experiment many, many times, get this curve, then this immediately implies the curve for the variance of the energy distribution as a function of time. And the expression is very simple, depending on your taste. This is the expression. I'll describe what it means. A of E is the derivative of this graph at average energy E. So this is the slope of this graph as we move as a function of time. And the variance is given by a term which depends on the initial conditions, which I don't want to describe, discuss at the moment. And then it's twice times this rate of energy change square, and an integral which depends on the whole history of the system of 1 over this rate of energy squared times the inverse temperature at energy E. So the inverse temperature, just to remind you, is given by the derivative of log of the number of state, volume and phase space, if you want to think classically, or the density of states, whatever you want. And that's probably, there are many ways to think about energy. It's probably the best way to think in the context of this talk is energy telling us how phase space is changing as we change the energy. And the result actually follows, as I'll argue, they're a direct result of time reversal symmetry. Okay, so implications of the result. So again, I want to remind you of the classical equilibrium way, and this is somehow comparing this result to this classical textbook result. So first of all, depending on the functional form of A, I remind you this is the derivative of the graph which tells you how the average energy changes the function of time, and how the inverse temperature depends on energy, the distribution can be larger and somewhat, the width of the distribution can be larger and somewhat surprisingly smaller than the equilibrium distribution, and I'll illustrate that in a second. So you essentially can get whatever you want. And the more surprising thing is that it's a history-dependent result. In contrast to this result, which tells you that it's independent of how the system got there, this result depends on the whole history of what happened to the system. The other thing is it's an integral, and when you look at an integral, you can imagine two scenarios, the integral being controlled by the upper bound or by the lower bound, and this gives rise to two distinct behaviors of the energy distribution, which I want to talk about now. So namely, if this integral diverges as E grows or converges, you get two distinct behaviors. Of course, it's an integral. You can cook up whatever you want. It doesn't have to be controlled by anything, but these are sort of generic scenarios. So I'll look at the last point for a very generic case where the inverse temperature scale is 1 over the energy to the power minus alpha. You can pick your system of choice. From positivity of the specific heat, this exponent has to be between 0 and 1. And then I'll take the rate at which energy increases in the system to be a power law in the energy. We have some examples where this work, but again, the main idea really doesn't depend on the feature, on the details. It really depends if the integral is controlled by the upper bound or by the lower bound. That's all there is. For this energy not to blow up at a finite time, we demand that S, this exponent, is smaller than 1. So these are the results. You essentially take the expression I gave you, you plug in the results, and you read them off. It's very simple. And we find three distinct behaviors, if you want two divided by a transition at a specific point. They're controlled by this exponent eta, which depends again on this exponent, which governs how the energy is increasing in the system, and the exponent that is related to the inverse temperature. We find that if this exponent is smaller than 0, then the width of the distribution is essentially like an equilibrium distribution up to a constant. So it essentially looks like an equilibrium distribution, can be slightly narrower, slightly wider. And if eta is very, very large, then you can see that it can be much narrower than the equilibrium distribution. Then, as you change this exponent, and I'll show you that you can actually pull this off. You can imagine experiments where you change this exponent. We find what we call a runaway regime, where the width of the distribution is much, much wider than the equilibrium distribution. You suddenly get the width, it's a dramatic transition, the width suddenly increases much beyond what the equilibrium one. And of course, it's an integral, so there's a region where you get the log, and this is the critical point. And again, the classification remains valid as long as the functions are monotonic, namely A of E. And for large negative eta, I'm just repeating this, the distribution becomes very narrow. If you ask how long does it take you to reach this asymptotic distribution, then you find out that this time diverges as you approach this critical point. So it's like a second order-like transition. This is a result that I'm not sure we have a good feeling for in terms of the entropy. If you ask how does the entropy has to grow as a function of time to cross between these two behavior? It turns out that the borderline is when the entropy grows as t squared. I don't have any feeling for why this t squared is there. Okay. Okay, there are any questions about the result so far? You've been awfully quiet, which can mean many things. Okay. Okay, so I'll go through the derivation. And I'll start with a really, really trivial example. It's so trivial I can do it on the slides as we go along. So we take a bunch of weakly interacting harmonic oscillators, and I put them to be weakly interacting so that the system can reach some thermal state. Okay, so it's not, it doesn't have a problem of not thermalizing. And the idea is that I'll grab one oscillator. You can see that you can generalize it to several oscillators. It's not a problem whatsoever. And I act on it with an impulse. So I change its momentum by an impulse, which depends in particular. So the coordinate of the oscillator is x. And you imagine that the force that I exert on the oscillator depends on the position at which it's at. And the momentum changes by p goes to p plus f of x delta t. And I assume that delta t is small for reasons that will become apparent shortly. So I assume that the impulse is short enough that the position doesn't change. That makes my calculation easy. And also, you'll see another reason for this to be valid. And then I'll let the system equilibrate between the pulses. This is what I call the first correction to the adiabatic limit before. And another thing is, which is more technical, I'll allow for the distribution of frequencies of these oscillators to be arbitrary, just so I can get different kinds of behaviors for these systems. So using the fact that between the impulses the system equilibrates, we can actually calculate the average change in energy and the variance of the change in energy, or the second cumulant of the change in energy. So you use the fact that for a single oscillator, the distribution is given by e to the minus beta e, and then it's a half a line calculation, and you find out that the average change in energy of the system, which I denote by the average of w, which is given by the force squared times delta t squared, and the cumulant is given by 2 over beta times the force squared times delta t squared. And the point is that if you look at these two expressions, they satisfy the relation that the variance and the first cumulant are related by beta times the variance, or the second cumulant is given by twice the first cumulant. And what I want to argue is that this fluctuation dissipation is completely general as long as we derive it under the right conditions. Those of you who know fluctuation theorems might guess it in your head immediately how I get these things. Well, that's... So if it doesn't equilibrate, then the simple answer is my results don't hold. Okay? That's the honest answer. I make the assumption, again, the assumption is that I drive the system slow enough that it has time to relax between my drives. So here it was the weak coupling between the oscillators. In other systems, this could be anything you want. You'll see. And then it won't help. This result won't hold. So we need something that thermalizes, which I think is pretty generic in nature. Okay, but that might be my opinion. Okay, yeah. Again, I don't want you to stick to this specific example. I promise you in a second, I'll derive this in very general terms, and maybe that will highlight when this is applicable and when not. Yeah. No, this is completely isolated, and this holds because it's coupled to, it's a small one oscillator in a large system. Okay? Yeah. The pulses, there's tons of freedom. You could have them regular as long as it relaxes. You can have them irregular. No. I'll give you the conditions for it to hold in a second. Okay? Okay. So what I want to point out that this relation that comes about from this specific, again, it's a very, very specific calculation. It's not meant to be the derivation by any means. It's just to illustrate how this thing works. And I want to argue that this relation is completely general up to one over n corrections. So once you have this relation between A and B, it's a very simple thing to do. You write down a Fokker-Planck equation which describes the evolution of the energy of the system. And it's essentially a two-line calculation to get this, not a two-line, okay, it's a four-line calculation to get this result. I want to mention that in the people who studied particles and chaotic cavities have written very similar expressions. You can find Fokker-Planck equations essentially similar by Chris Yerzynski. Doron Cohen has a review on these things. I think Ott made an important contribution, as far as I understand, in 79, and the approach writing Fokker-Planck equations to describe such processes, I think it goes back to Chirikov in the 70s. Okay, so we have weakly, but somehow nobody did this calculation that I'm showing you. So we have weakly interacting harmonic oscillator, and the other thing I want to say is that you can choose the force that acts on the force that acts during the impulse to be some power law just as a choice. It's not really important what I'm saying, but the point is that if you choose the distribution of oscillators right, you can actually get the transition between this Gibbs-like distribution and this narrow distribution. That's the point I'm making, that it's possible, even with this really, really simple system, to get this transition between the two regimes by changing the nature of this forcing. Okay, so I want to now give a completely general derivation and give you all the conditions for this thing to hold. Okay? So I'll do the general derivation by something, by a fluctuation theorem. If you want, I'll do it through what's called the Crookes equality, which goes back to Gavin Crookes. And I think fluctuation dissipations can be attributed to people like Dennis Evans, Scalavotti and Cohen, and Chris Yerzynski. It's something that could have been discovered 100 years ago, but somehow sat unnoticed. And I'll worry about 1 over n corrections, and I'll also worry about getting these fluctuation relations for an isolated system and saying when does it hold there, because I noticed by comments by people and referees that people assume that there's a coupling to an infinite bath, and I want to discuss this in detail. So I want to do this classically, again, because I think it gives some intuition, but there's a equivalent quantum derivation which you can ask us about. So what I want to use is, I want to use Liouville's theorem, which tells you that the volume and phase space are conserved under the dynamics. This is essentially for the quantum guys, it's like saying that the von Neumann entropy is conserved under the dynamics. It's exactly the same statement. And then I'll assume that I have an Hamiltonian which depends on some external parameter, lambda, as a function of time. And for a given lambda, the dynamics have time reversal symmetry. That's all I'll assume. And the idea is that I'll choose a process, and again, I'm going back to my piston that's connected now to a larger system, but the whole system will be isolated. I'll consider a process where I take this piston and I change the parameter lambda as a function of time between time 0 and tau, and I'll call this the forward process. And then, you'll see why it's useful, I'll go and I'll show you the reverse process where I start with the parameter and its final time and punch it back in. For us, we imagine periodic cycles, so I'll imagine lambda starting and ending at the same value at the end of the day. By the way, there's about, these things, once you get the hang of them, there are about 5 minutes to prove, and there are by now, I think, 15,000 proofs of all these relations, and this is just my favorite because I was involved in it. Anyway, so the idea is the following. We have a classical system, so I'm drawing what I can on two dimensions. Volume and phase space, which corresponds to an energy E. That's what my budget allows me to plot. And then I look at another surface in phase space, which has an energy E plus W. And I ask, and I know just by, I know that, I don't know, but I'm assuming that there's a set of initial conditions on this energy surface, which if I change the parameter lambda of T, you can imagine moving the piston, then at the end of the process, they end up on the surface with energy E plus W. So I'm looking at all of phase space, and I'm picking up the initial conditions such that when I start at these, I end up at a surface with energy E plus W. This is the work done. It is. So I'm choosing the exact locations which will end up at that W. So every location, I'll get back to that in a second, any location here will end up at a different W. Okay? So I don't, and of course the flow and phase space doesn't look as nice, but I 2D, that's what I have. Okay? So by time reversal symmetry, I know that there's a set of initial conditions on this surface. Imagine reversing the momenta on the surface with energy E plus W, that if I start with them, they go back to the surface with energy sigma of E. Okay, once you make this observation, you're done. Okay, so the probability of making a forward work in the forward direction W, starting at energy E, is given by this volume, sorry for the sigma, I just noticed this, by the volume, this volume and phase space, divided by the total initial volume and phase space. I'm assuming initial conditions, which I'm at equilibrium, so every microstate is equally probable. So it's given by this ratio by basic stat mech. And then you ask, what's the probability of doing a work minus W, given that I started on the surface with energy E plus W? It's given by the same volume by time reversal symmetry divided by this different volume and phase space. And now you just divide the two, and you find out the probability of making a forward work W at energy E divided by the probability of doing a reverse work minus W starting at E plus W is given by E to the entropy differences between the two surfaces. Okay? In our case, the final and initial values of the parameters, because we imagine a periodic cycle, are exactly the same. Okay? And again, you can do the same thing in a quantum mechanical language. It comes out exactly the same. So the difference between a reversible and an irreversible process is that for an irreversible process, you start on some surface and you're sampling phase space. You're sort of jumping between different regions in phase space. And for a reversible system, we start with a given volume and phase space, and we always everything from the surface flows to exactly a surface of exactly the same volume and phase space. This is sort of a modern, I don't know if it's modern or the old people knew it, that's why they call it non-reversible. It's sort of a modernish look at what you teach when you teach thermodynamics. So now we're essentially done. We have the ratio of the probabilities equal to E to the different in entropies. Now I've used the fact that my parameter lambda is the same at the start and end of the process. So what you do now is you expand in this W like you do in textbook. This gives you corrections, which means that the whole relation is valid when the amount of work that you're doing is much, much smaller than the specific heat of the whole system. So that's a rather weak requirement. And then the next thing I do is I expand the probability of doing a reverse work starting at E plus W by this W, which is again much, much smaller than the total energy of the system. And this is, if you want, a 1 over n correction. And at the end of the day, up to 1 over n corrections, we get what's called the Cook's equality that tells you that the probability of doing the work plus W divided the probability of doing the work minus W is equal to E to the beta W. Okay, so this is a symmetry relation imposed by, if you want, conservation of phase space and time reversal symmetry. And again, it goes back to Gavin Crookes in 1999, who derived it first for stochastic dynamics. Okay, I'm running out of time. It's okay. Okay. So once you have this, then you just move this exponent to this other side, move this probability to the other side, integrate over all W, and you get what's called the Elzinski relation, which was found by Elzinski in 1997, and it essentially tells you that the average of E to the minus beta W over all repeated experiments is equal to 1, and because we're dealing with an isolated system, it's true up to 1 over n corrections. Okay, which is sort of what you expect because all the derivations are couple the system to a bath, so it's not too surprising that you have 1 over n corrections. And once you have this, we want to write down a Fokker-Planck equation. So you look at the cumulants of the work and everything up to 1 over n. So you want to calculate cumulants. You look at log of the average of this quantity over all histories, and you expand this, and you find out that if things are small enough, then you get a relation between the second cumulant and the first cumulant, and it's exactly the same relation that I got by using the simple trivial harmonic oscillator example, and you write down the Fokker-Planck equation, and you're done. And again, this is a condition that this is the condition for the whole framework to work, and it's that beta squared times the third cumulant of the work is much, much smaller than the first cumulant of the work. So this is, if you want, the quasi-static demand. We have some tricks in some cases to overcome this demand, but I'm not going to get into that in this talk. Okay, so far, isolated system. Any questions so far? No, I start with an isolated system. Isolated systems also equilibrate, okay, by you want to think about it quantum mechanically or classically. And that equilibrated, and then I start driving it. Okay? I don't need to couple it to Bath in any stage of the process. That's why I went through all this whole derivation of showing that the Yerzynski equality holds even for a completely isolated system. There's no coupling to a bath in any way. The only thing I have to assume is that the work I'm doing is smaller compared to the energy of the rest of the system. Yeah.
So the issue with the Chasinski relation is often that you basically can compare the work to beta. So one point gets expensive and one gets, intensive. But your condition seems to be weaker, so you can perform work much larger than KBT, but you make a statement about fluctuations.
There's no condition on Yerzynski's.
Okay.
In real life applications, the conditions are essentially this is the strongest condition for the Yerzynski to hold. For our thing, we again demand that the third cumulant is small. So the condition for the Yerzynski is this guy, that you're much, much smaller than the specific heat of the whole system for an isolated system. And for us, this is the requirement. And Anatoly, you have a comment. Yeah, this is, sorry, I should have stressed it. This is why we're doing a cumulant expansion. That's a much, much weaker condition than moments. Okay? That's why we're dealing with cumulants, and that's what you need in the Fokker-Planck equation. Okay, any other questions? So far we're dealing with an isolated system, and what I want to do now is I want to tell you that these ideas can be generalized to account for a system that is driven and coupled to a bath. So the idea is that we have a system that we're driving in the same way that we did before. There's some external potential that's changing as a function of time, driving system into energy into the system. If you want, this is our piece of vegetable inside a microwave, and it's dissipating energy into the bath, which is our environment inside the microwave, I guess. So the idea, I won't go through all the steps of this. The ideas are a modification of what I've shown you before. Now you have to consider a two-dimensional Fokker-Planck equation for the energy of system one and the system to which it's coupled. You can reduce it to a Fokker-Planck equation of one variable, and you find out that this is the Fokker-Planck equation that you have. And now you have this fluctuation dissipation relation, which looks more terrifying, but it contains essentially the average rate at which you're pumping into energy into the system, while the average rate of energy flowing between system one and system two. And that's related to the, if you want, the diffusion constant in this Fokker-Planck equation by all these inverse temperatures, where beta 1 is the inverse temperature of system 1, and beta 2 is the inverse temperature of system 2. So it's this equation that we have, and I want to illustrate this. So the first case, no driving, just dissipation. We have a setup that's similar to the experiments, one experiment that was described this morning. But again, under the conditions that I'm talking about, we have two systems which are coupled to each other, and we ask, how do they reach equilibrium with one another? Can we say something about the energy fluctuations on the way? And the first time I gave this talk, I was in England, so they suggested this teacup analogy, where you throw in many, many teacups in the room at the same initial energy, and you ask, how does the distribution of energies of the teacups reach the final equilibrium cool off as they're inside the room. And the only thing I'll assume is that the entropy of the...
So now in this situation, you don't have any constraint on how it is that you are, when you are driving the system, not this case. You basically thermalize compared to the bath. There must be some condition between the two.
No, before, again, the result that I'm saying, I'll be able to say something about how this setup reaches a steady state. And also, and I'll try to show a more interesting result, I think, about characterizing the steady state of this guy.
But there's no relation between the two?
No. No, the temperature of this guy can be whatever you want. Okay? So the only thing I'll assume is that the entropy of the combined system, so this is a weak coupling assumption if you think about small systems, that the entropy of the combined system, one at energy E1 and one at energy E2, is given by the entropy of system one at energy E1 plus the entropy of system two at energy E2. So there's a weak coupling between the systems. I'm sort of stressing this because both one of the referees and a DAE didn't agree with this expression. But I guess that living in the Middle East, I'm used to a small number of silly people controlling my life. Anyway, tough crowd. Okay, then you can show this fluctuation relation that E to the change in entropy of the two systems, the average over many repeated exchanges is equal to 1. And you can use this and follow the same steps that I've shown before. And what you find out is this expression, and I want to compare it to the expression that we had before for an isolated system. So for an isolated system, we had that the variance of the energy distribution was equal to this expression. I remind you, this is the rate at which we're pumping energy into the system. And this is the inverse temperature of system one at energy E1. And then we do the same thing for the two equilibrating systems, and we find out that it's exactly the same expression, but now we have a difference of the two inverse temperatures of the two systems. So it's exactly the same relation, but instead of having a beta 1 here, we have a difference of inverse temperatures. And just formally, if you look at this, this implies that coupling to drive is essentially equivalent to coupling to a system at infinite temperature. And again, this gives you the fluctuations in the dynamics of the full equilibration process involved. And this is just a test of this result. So this is two equilibrated systems. These are hard spheres, molecular dynamics simulations, one light, one heavy, which are bumping into each other. And what you do is you measure the energy of, say, the red balls as a function of time. And this is a specific realization of the experiment. The energy is fluctuating as a function of time until it saturates, fluctuating about its equilibrium value. And if you average over many, many experiments, you find out this smooth curve. Again, this is a numerical measurement of the way that energy is transferring between these two hard sphere systems. And if you plot the variance of the energy of the red balls as a function of the energy, you find that this is the curve. The dots are the numerically measured result, and the blue is the result of the theory. And I want to emphasize that this was done for 30 light particles and 20 heavy particles, which means that even though we have 1 over n corrections to the system, they're not affecting our results. 1 over 30 is not a really large number that we have to worry about this. So they hold even for mesoscopic systems, and you don't have to really aggressively take the thermodynamic limit. And the second case I'll describe is now this driven dissipative system. And again, you can write down an expression for the full time evolution of the variance. And you can go to Guy's poster if you want to see the full expression in all its glory. But what I want to do is show you results for the steady state. And the idea is the following. If you look at, so we're pumping energy into system one, and it's dissipating energy into a bath at system energy T2. And then this is settling into a non-Gibbsian steady state, where again, it's always, E1 is always at equilibrium by our assumption, but this whole energy is fluctuating as a function of time. And I'm interested in, how much? 5 minutes, okay, I'm okay. I'm interested in quantifying the fluctuations of the energy of the system at steady state. And what we find out is this relation, and I have to explain this relation. So you measure the energy as a function of time of system E1, and then you measure the autocorrelation as a function of time of the energy of this system, and you find out that the correlations decay exponentially as a function of time. This is, again, a specific numeric, the green curve. And you find out that the correlations decay with a time scale which is given by tau. And then we find the following relation, that the relaxation time of the system, of the time scale for the autocorrelations of the energy of the system, times the average rate of energy flowing through the system at steady state, is equal by this combination of the inverse temperatures of this system and this system, times the variance of the energy of this system. So it's sort of a two-temperature fluctuation dissipation relation, which is derived by coupling it to a bath. And this is just a numerical check that it works. And you can notice that it even works when the ratio of the temperatures of one system and the other, Guy can correct me, works up to 70, if I remember correct, the difference in factor of 70 between the temperatures of the two systems. So even though this temperature of this one is 70 times larger than the temperature of this one, the relation still holds. And how much time do I have?
Two more minutes.
So I'll skip the derivation. This is just the derivation of this guy. I'll try and early. The last system, which you can say, again, the approach is completely modular. So the last system I'll consider is a system where I couple to two external baths, sort of a prototypical driven out of equilibrium system, but again, in this limit where we can say very, very concrete statements without solving specific models. And the idea is, again, that we're looking for to characterize, we can write down how this system reaches its steady state, but we want to characterize the steady state, and we find out that now the relaxation timescale of the autocorrelation of the energy of this system times the average rate of energy flow to the system is related to the fluctuations in this energy times this expression, which has now three temperatures. So we have a three-temperature fluctuation dissipation relation with inverse temperatures of this system, and this system. And again, you can play this game and get five temperatures or whatever you want if you make very, very complicated setups as you move along. Okay, so I want to summarize. For a driven isolated system, noisy potential, driving on purpose, whatever you want, if you know how the average energy increases as a function of time, if things are slow enough under the conditions I gave, and I want to say that we have some exactly solvable models where things are non-trivial, it actually works better than you would guess naively if you want to come ask me afterwards. But these are specific examples. So if you know this guy, then you essentially know the variance. It's a very simple expression. It's history dependent in contrast to heating with a thermal bath. We find two broadly different regimes, equilibrium-like and runaway-like. You can check this for a whole host of models. You can generalize it to thermalizing systems, and you can generalize it to driven dissipative systems, and you get fluctuation-like relations. And it's similarly to a system driven by two baths. One comment, you can imagine going better than what we did and sort of giving more information on higher accumulants of the energy to give better information about how the energy distribution in the system goes. What we are having hints from numerics is that it breaks down as you increase the energy that you're pumping into the system, it breaks down at a very, very specific point. And this might be, this is complete speculation, this might be a manifestation of the fact that there's a theorem telling you that Fokker-Planck equations, either that there are two important terms or that all terms are important when you describe the evolution of the system. So it might be that there's a point where there's no escaping. You have to tell me everything about the system so I can give specific statements about the system and the limit. And there's a whole regime where you have to tell me only very little information. And that's sort of a universal quote-unquote regime. So thank you very much for your time.
So there is room. Yeah, please.
In the situation where you have driven but dissipating systems, you are again assuming that they obey the sort of canonical.
Sorry, they return to the microcanonical distribution.
I'm assuming that things are slow enough so that the system is essentially always very close to equilibrium. That's the assumption that allows me to derive. Otherwise, you know, you have to play the usual game of solving specific models, which is a good game, but it's not this game.
So there is room for, okay. What happens when you drive an isolated system and it goes through a phase transition, or you drive it directly to the phase transition? Is there anything unusual in that case?
The one thing that I have to comment, if you're going through a critical point, then the equilibration time will be longer and longer, so this will be harder and harder to reach. And if you assume that this holds all the way, then there's nothing spectacular. We looked at cases, there's nothing spectacular happening at a critical point.
And the second question, how can you physically get this wide runaway regime?
The right-of-way regime, you just change the way to which the rate at which you're injecting energy into the system.
So you think it's physically realizable?
That was what I was arguing, even for the simple coupled harmonic oscillators, you can change the impulse and drive it from one regime to another regime.
Okay.
And again, this is, okay, you see, this is the...
Even in macroscopic system, you say you can do this.
Well, you have to have one. We have one of. What do you mean by microscopic? One
over in macroscopic. In macroscopic system.
Macroscopic.
Can you do this?
Yeah, but the fluctuations will be small. You want something where you can observe the fluctuations. So you want something mesoscopic to measure these things.
Okay.
And again, the point about making general statements. Their problem is that you have to tell me a specific system, and then we have to discuss things. That's the usual problem.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. Okay, so our next speaker is Masahito Ueda. He is from University of Tokyo, and he is going to talk about information thermodynamics, only the classical part, right, of the Sealer engine.